Hello, Yes But Why listeners. This is your host, Amy Jordan. Welcome to Yes But Why, episode 290, my conversation with improviser and parent support coach, Lori Wagner-Storley. But first, let's talk about our sponsors. Yes But Why podcast is sponsored by Audible. Sign up today for your 30-day free trial at audibletrial.com/yesbutwhy. You get a free audiobook download as well as access to hundreds of books and podcasts. You know, everybody I know has Audible. People are talking about reading so many more books these days. I feel like the more we read, the better we are. And it's been a really great way for me to connect with friends from the past and people that I know here in Austin. So I don't have time to sit down with a book anymore. And you know, honestly, I'm so exhausted from everything that I'm doing that I can't even like look at a book without falling asleep. But when I'm driving around and doing errands, I can listen to books on Audible and I can, you know, listen to things that I never would have thought that I would be into. But it's been a really great resource. And, you know, I just want you guys to have it too. So go to audibletrial.com/yesbutwhy, and then you can get your own Audible account and access to everything that you'd like. And also you're supporting Yes But Why podcast, and yay, I like that, and you like that, and I like you, and it's going to be great. Our other sponsor is PodcastCadet.com. PodcastCadet.com is the company that my husband Chris and I run to help podcasters. This is a company that was created when we started doing podcasts. We were helping our friends with all sorts of different things, and then we ended up going to a bunch of podcast festivals and learning all sorts of stuff and making connections with people that do all sorts of different kind of podcasting things, from like editing to marketing. And so now we're like, hey, we have this information. We'd love to help you out. So if you want to start a podcast, or someone you know wants to start a podcast and they need some help, just send them to us. We do a lot of free consultations. And then if you want to, you know, sign up for a service or get a workshop from us, you can get a discount. You can get 20% off if you use the Yes But Why code YBY20. And, you know, we're just there for you. We want to help you. And it's something that, you know, we figured out along the way. And so, you know, we just want to share the information. So check us out. And please, if we can help you, connect with us. PodcastCadet.com. Yes But Why podcast is also brought to you by True Hemp Science. I don't know about you guys, but CBD has been just kind of a game changer. It's kind of helpful to me in the lotions. You know, I never thought that that was a thing, but it just sort of calms my hands somehow. Like, I've been having a lot of trouble, a little carpal tunnel, you know, with my hands. And so being able to have this lotion that can sort of ease some of that has been really great. And this is a great company, Austin based. And, you know, we met the owner. Great dude. He's also out at farmers markets and whatnot. So like, he's a great guy. Connect with him, give your money to local resources. Please, if you're thinking about getting some CBD for somebody on your Christmas list, go to True Hemp Science. They have all the CBD products that you need. Use code YESBUTY7 to get 7% off your order of $50 or more. And they'll include a free packet of CBD edibles with your order. So check it out and support local, and, you know, get your family some CBD to calm them down with TrueHempScience.com. This week on Yes But Why, I connected with child development expert Lori Wagner-Storley about how she facilitates improv games to show her clients parenting hacks. So helpful. Lori is also host of the podcast Improvised Parenting, in which she interviews creatives about parenting. I might be on a future episode. Listen in to my interview with Lori as we chat about performing, parenting, and playing pool. I now present to you Yes But Why episode 290, Lori Wagner-Storley on using the Yes And philosophy of improv to fix every part of your life. Enjoy. Thank you.
I'm Amy Jordan, and this is Yes But Why Podcast. Yeah.
All right, so let's jump in. Let's start with my first question, which is, what was the way that you were creative as a little kid? How did you play?
Well, that's a really great question because I think about it all the time. When I was 7 or 8 years old, let's say that would have been what, second grade to about all of elementary school, I lived in this neighborhood, you know, and at a time period where we were told to go outside. It wasn't like, Mom, can I go outside and play with my friends? It's like, get outside and play. Okay, all right. So, you know, my neighbor across the street, Joelle Fennell, she and I used to pretend we were TV characters. I was, of course, policewoman. And she was Get Christy Love because those were airing at the same time. And, you know, we both identified with those strong female characters. So we would go around our neighborhood looking for kids that were breaking the law. So that was how we played dramatic play, role play. And, you know, we loved it. It was so much fun to play act and pretend not everybody understood what we were doing, but we had fun doing it.
You know, I totally did that too. And people are always talking smack about kids watching TV, but I was like, I was raised by television. I understand and I appreciate the idea that the TV that we watched as a kid always had happy endings. So like that gave us this false sense of security in life. And I appreciate that. But it's not like that anymore. There are lots of shows where it's like, I was watching a kid's show with my 4-year old and it was like this show about this dragon and then the dragon died. And I was like, I guess. Well, so that's a thing that happens.
Did your child cry?
He was very upset, and as well he should be. It was a very upsetting scene, you know. But I was like, oh, okay. So it didn't work out for the main character. Sorry, kiddo. Life is tough. You know, now these days you can talk to them about stuff that's a little bit more real. But yeah, I mean, I want to say that what did I role play with my friends? We role played Dirty Dancing. I realized later we did not understand the deeper, like, thematic events of Dirty Dancing. But when I was 8, we were dancing around and telling each other not to put baby in the corner. And like that was... And like pretending to carry watermelons places. Like that was what we were doing. We thought, but I mean, technically the like world of that is like a summer camp where there's dancing. And it was great. I was like, where's the summer camp with dancing? And my parents were like, why are you watching this movie? And I was like, you weren't home. So
I'm a latchkey kid. What do you want?
I turned the TV on when I came home from school and this was what was on. I didn't buy HBO. You did. Man. But yeah, I think role play based on television characters and stuff like that is really helpful. I mean, even just the idea of storytelling, you know, from a little, from a young age. Yeah. I think it's really valid. Kind of,
some things that you just said reminded me of being like, I think in 4th or 5th grade and being at camp. And one of the things I did was I wrote a play and I directed it and I acted in it. And, you know, it was just something that made sense to me. Yeah. Probably because I watched a lot of television. And it's funny because now this is dawning on me because we forget about these things in life. But this is dawning on me because my daughter has done the same thing. At 6 years old, she wrote a script, like a 2-page script. She filmed it and she had her friend over and her friend was acting in it. Her friend and grandpa were the main actors in this play she wrote. And I was like, oh, that's so cute. She's so brilliant. And I was like, oh, my God. You know, so it is maybe just how we write ourselves on to the world we want ourselves to be in. So like we take characters that we know and we put ourselves in their shoes and then we add on to it. So it's like, oh, yeah, that one I resonate with. I want to add on to this. I'm just going to have pink hair and this. And then you put it out in the world and it's going to speak whatever you have to say.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And it also allows you to say more about who you think you are. then you're able to communicate in a real way. I mean, you don't know how that you're not given the tools, certainly not our generation. We were not given the tools to explain, this is the kind of person I am. This is how I see the world. But you could certainly say, oh, I'm a lot like Laverne. She's brash and she's not afraid to talk to anybody. She got friends, you know, like things like that, where you're like, you associate with characters because they represent what you think of yourself, even though we underestimate children all the time. We think, oh, they don't understand. Like, I remember before I had a child, I definitely thought that kids like just didn't understand anything. And the my four-year-old's emotional intelligence is high. Like, he feels so much. That's the other part about television. He feels every emotion in these movies, you know, like things that are going on. Like, he'll cry at exactly the right moment to cry. Like, and I'm like, how does he understand? But like, we're processing storytelling and understanding every bit of, you know, everything that comes at us, you know, we are taking in and turning into something.
I want to add on to that, because this really brings something up for me that I want parents to really hear and understand, is that our children come into the world with one language, and that is the language of their emotions, right? So that our kids are like throwing fits all the time because this is how they talk to us. When they cry, they need something. Different types of cries mean different things to, you know, to every parent from each child. And this is the language they are translating the world from, you know, they're receiving the world from, and they're giving and they're communicating to you with, because the language of, what do we call words? I mean, this words fail us all the time. Still in my 50s, I can tell you, it's oftentimes hard to find the words, oftentimes hard to express what's going on in my feelings. And this is where we fall short in relationships, where we get challenged in relationships, is how do I express myself? Because I'm feeling this thing, but if I'm feeling anger, I certainly don't want to be like, roar to the person, because that could be scary. So I have to kind of temper that a little bit and then express it. Like we were talking about earlier, about how we kind of, okay, this is happening. This feeling is coming up. How do I express it in a way that will be communicated? So there's a lot of process that goes into speaking.
Yeah.
With words.
Plus, I don't think I truly understood even what you're talking about until now in my 40s. Like, the idea of processing emotions and then like figuring out the best way to communicate them. No way. Like, I was not the best emotional communicator in my 20s or 30s. At all. You know, like, I needed the time and the distance from a lot of events in my life to understand how they, you know, developed. It's wild.
It is wild. And we have to recognize that we all have gone through that same experience, because now we know so much more. We have access to all the information, right? So if you have a question about why is my kid throwing a tantrum at age two? I mean, you'll find several articles, informed science journals, all these kind of things that will explain why this happens. And it's because of, you know, the emotions that are flooding a child's brain become overwhelming for them, and they can't express themselves to you. They can't express their needs in a way that you would understand. The only thing they can do is just let it out. Isabella, my daughter, said to me at 2.5 years old, she was having a moment, a tantrum in the backseat of the car while I'm driving. And I'm like, oh my God, I'm going to crash. And, you know, I'm like, how can I help you? What's going on, honey? Is everything okay? Yes, mommy. I just have feelings and I need to get them out of my body. And I was like, oh, yeah. That's right. You get those feelings out. That was so informative to me. But she just, when she was brought up in this environment, not just me, but my mentor and all my other fellow teachers, where we talk to them about their feelings when they're coming in. Oh, I see you're frustrated. Oh, I see you're having, this is happening for you. So they already know what's happening, because we're telling them, or we're sharing with them what it looks like to us. Broadcasting is what we call it. And what's remarkable about that is it gives them language to identify what's happening with their emotions. So as long as we as parents can support that for them, you know, and tell them, I had an older, like a grandma in my program, come up to me afterwards in tears and say, I wish I had been able to say I was frustrated when I was a little kid. I mm-hmm. wasn't even allowed to say that. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh my God, I was so moved. I have goosebumps now just remembering that moment, because it dawned on me then. I was like, that's how powerful this is for our kids, right? Not just for us, but for our kids, is like growing up, like two generations behind me, they weren't even allowed to have those feelings of frustration yeah. or to their misbehave, right? Mm-hmm. So if they have feelings, that's labeled as misbehavior, and you can't do that in society. So put that somewhere else, like all the way down in your tummy till you get stomach cancer in your 50s, right? So like, no, we're not doing that anymore.
Yeah.
We're not doing that anymore.
So speaking of expression as a child and a different generation than our children, which yeah. is our generation, I think you and I are a few years apart. I'm a Gen Xer. I don't know if that's where you're at in the world of generations, cultural generation phrases.
I'm between Boomer and Gen Xer, I think.
Right. Let's go with Gen X. It's a good time. there's a lot we can say where we're like, oh, I didn't know. They didn't teach us that. All I had was DARE and after school specials. That's what taught me my life. But so you're writing plays at summer camp. Did you continue to express yourself as a writer as you got older? Were your parents pro this sort of artistic expression? Or since they were probably in the same generation as this grandmother, were yeah. they like, that's nice that you know how to use a pen, honey. Please stop telling people what to say. Like, how did it manifest for your family? Were they like into it? Were they excited to hear your stories? Or was it kind of like a, hey, why don't you deal with that somewhere else?
Well, I was basically a latchkey kid in the 1970s. So both my parents were working most of the time. I don't think there was time to really observe what I was doing in my play, in my free time. So I did spend a lot of the time reading Beverly Cleary books and chapter books. Mm. When the bookmobile came to town, I was, you know, nerd card in hand there, you know, and I was getting all of the latest books. So for me, that was a way to also explore my imagination and to, you know, writing has never been a strong part of my, I don't know, skill set. I always struggled around writing, like taking as an improv actor, you want to next level it. And, you know, you have this great character that came up for you during an improv and you want to write something for that character and bring it to life. I had done a few sketches kind of just off the cuff. I wrote a book of poetry probably in the 90s, but I never felt like a solid writer.
Even though like that was your first thing.
Yeah. Even though that was my first thing and I wrote an entire book, I have a suitcase full of all the drafts of it, of poetry and, you know, kind of the stuff that you see now, like, you know, just quippy stuff, and then pass the book kind of stuff, like Kerouac style. Like I read a line, another person writes, we go around the table and everybody writes a line and it becomes this wonderfully improvised story. And, you know, I put that all in a book. And the sketches I wrote, I don't know. It just never, it was, here's, I feel like what we were talking about earlier, like I write it and then off it goes, almost like one of those sand mandalas, like you do it and then whew, the wind comes and it's gone. And you're like, okay, where are we going to put the next one? You know, that was me always, except for with the exception of that book. Like I can't tell you where my sketch writings are. I have no idea.
Sure.
I can't tell you where any of the acting footage that I did is. I don't know. I have to Google it. I don't know. And honestly, like I've done a movie, two commercials, a TV show and a game show where I won $20,000 playing pool. Where's the footage? I don't know. I honestly don't. My mom
wasn't what it wasn't what was important to you to remember. But this poetry session, this like, was it all improvised? Was it like a group work? Was it like a workshop that you developed this in? Maybe it was just a great experience.
It was just a great experience. It was a collective hive. I often look at it like the Dorothy Parker era, where we're all sitting around smoking cigarettes and drinking martinis and being wise beyond our years. And, you know, and then that's just what we did. And, you know, we were all just like these artistic people who like to hang out together. And so the Pass the Book thing came because I love Jack Kerouac.
Yeah.
And I was an improviser. So I thought, this is brilliant. This is what I love about Jack Kerouac, that he's kind of off the cuff, you know, like whimsical. And, you know, he would just go around with the people and write. And so that's what we did.
Probably lucky that nobody got Jack Kerouac into an improv troupe, because we never would read. We would have never read any of the books that he wrote, because he would have been like putting them out on stage. No, I just mean like, instead of writing it down, because you mentioned this idea of like, you know, you consider yourself an improviser but not a writer. And I think it's because those two things are like two different sides of the brain. And we as artists have a tendency to put ourselves in a box and say, oh, I can do this one thing right. But I truly think that we're creative people. And so we have a breadth of skills that we can use at different times. Now, once you get yourself involved in improv as a practice, as a study, you very much have to quiet the writing part of your brain, because because you don't want to be writing the scene as you're in it. You want to just experience it and like live in the moment, right? So you really have to shut off that voice that's constantly writing stories. But I don't think one is better than the other. I just feel like one's more exercised than the other sometimes. And depending upon what crowd you're in, sometimes one is more prized than the other. But I think they all come from the same storytelling essence in our, you know, souls, you know?
I think you're right. And I think it's like dependent on what muscles we're flexing at the moment, so to speak. So you expressed it so perfectly that, you know, you're just experiencing in the moment. And I look at my life as one big improv, you know, like one big improv scene. So I'm going, you know, from scene to scene and growing and growing and growing outward, expanding as I am, as the universe expands, I also expand. And I just continue to add to it. Yes. And yes. And yes. And I don't document. I don't write it down. I'm not using that part of my brain. It's not that I don't feel like I can't, although sometimes I do say that to myself. You're not a writer, Laura.
So many people say that to themselves, though. So many people. Certainly within improv, right?
Yeah.
Because they've exercised the part of their brain that lives in the moment so hard that they truly don't think they have the ability to just... But it's like, dude, it's the same thing. It's just the... Instead of working with another person, you're just working with your... You know, me, myself, and I are doing a scene in my head, and then I'm also typing while it's happening. Like, when people say they hear voices in their head as characters, because writers, there's like articles where people say like they hear the characters' voices. I don't hear the characters' voices, but I definitely feel the lines. Like, I can just sit and be like, okay, if this were happening, how would it go? And it just comes out because I'm improvising the scene in my brain and then just letting it come out my fingers, right? But
you're right.
Hey. You are like not the first person ever to say I'm not a writer when clearly you're a writer, like in so many ways, in so many ways. Also, because I know a larger breadth of like what you do, and it's like, yo, you're a writer. Like, but I appreciate that improv has a strong hold on you. I don't know about you. I'm not religious, but for me, improv has a very philosophical hold on me in a way that it sort of represents what religion would be for me. If I were religious, it would be improv. right? Like, yeah. I'm not so interested in any of the organized religions that exist. I've been parts of some. I've enjoyed, I love a good service. If you believe in it, I'm excited for you. Like, man, when I meet religious people and they like, you can see them all filled with it. I'm like, yeah, this is so great. But I feel that way about creativity as well. If like you're telling me about how you're like building this prop and you're like, and then I took the glue. I'm like, tell me everything. Like, I'm just like super into people being excited for stuff. So tell me then what you're clearly like banging the drum of improv right now. How did you even find that? Like, what, where in your life was someone like, hey, let's do some improv? Like, cause it's almost not even, it's a thing, you know, globally now, but it, I mean, it hasn't been for most of our lives. So how did you even get involved?
I've thought about this so much and I've put so much kind of like trying to get in that, you know, lost part of my brain where I know the answer, that theta state, and trying to really find that. And I think it's been in me since I was born. I just knew how to do it. I was always good on my feet. That's a skill that I've had my entire life. I could handle any situation that was thrown in front of me. And so it got labeled as improv, later on in life when I started to do theater and, started to watch, like short form, because short form games were fun. And my brain is wired for games. So like throw a game in front of me, I'm like, yeah, I'm a master. I'm gonna do it. So that's kind of my entree into it was the short form. Viola Spolin, all that stuff really informed me. So it identified it for me. So it built the building around what I've already believed. So to speak. So if we're talking religious speak, and I agree with you that the philosophy of yes, and is something that I am trying to, I've seen it transferred into a TED talk. And I'm trying to do that with the basis that parenting is a yes, and a philosophy, because we are all improvisers on the daily with our kiddos. And we have to, we have to give ourselves some slack around that and know that we can lean into some rules around improv and feel good about it. Like it's really so positive. I mean, one of my favorite, since we're on this topic of TEDx talks, is this girl, Emma McInerney, I think it is. She talks about when she was 7 years old walking on the beach and she found this thing that looked like a dinosaur foot to her. And so she said to her mom, "Mom, I think this is, a dinosaur foot." And the two words that her mom said to her changed her entire life and informed her entire life. Yeah, maybe. And I was like, oh, yeah, I am. That's the same thing. And so she does this whole talk about how now she runs this clothing company in San Francisco that's built for women who like men's clothes, And because she would never be able to find clothes that fit her. She was always drawn to the more masculine type of clothing, but it never fit her right, And so she created it because she said it to her friend and her friend said, yeah, maybe. And that's informed her whole life. And so I feel like that if we give that like almost like an open check, right, to your imagination with those two words, yeah, maybe, or yes, and, or whatever, what philosophy you want to subscribe to, your kid could do anything. I think there was a part of my life that my mom did that. She told me that you can be anything you want to be. And I believed it, and she kept telling me that and I believed it. And so I kept doing it. I just kept doing whatever I wanted. And that's kind of like in the background of my mind, the engine that drives me is I do what I want, bitch.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I feel the same way. I feel the same way. Like there's a lot of people held back by what they think they should do, what they think is the right thing to do. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, no, I just do what I want. I'm like, hey, I'm going to do what I want. So you feel free. Like do what you want because I'm going to hear what you have to say, but, oh, that's really interesting. Your thoughts on that thing. Yeah. I'm going to still do what I want. Like, you know what I mean? Like, we are who we are, and you might as well just sort of like embrace what that is. So I want to go back to, you mentioned that, like, you felt like improv was always something that you like just had inside of you. Like, is it something that like, but when you, so you found the games on TV, I'm assuming Whose Line Is It Anyway, or one of the other British things, because it was mostly, the early ones were all from the UK.
Yeah, it was before that. Yeah, because Whose Line wasn't out until after I already knew about Comedy Sports and Viola Spolin. I found Viola Spolin.
Yeah, how did you know Viola Spolin? Oh, you found the book. Okay, because I was like, dude, I didn't even find out about her until like 6 years into taking classes somewhere. And I was like, what? This is the original idea? Like, so tell me about finding that. What did you do?
I had an amazing acting coach here in Pennsylvania that I don't even remember. I remember being on stage and when it dawned on me, right? So I'm doing a dramatic scene and I was all, you know, this is acting class, and I come out and I'm doing a dramatic scene, but I was raised on Saturday Night Live, Fridays. I was raised on Jerry Lewis. I'm a sucker for a sight gag, right? I'm all about, you know, those, you know, pratfalls and whatnot. Raised on Jerry Lewis, raised on Carol Burnett. And I come out into the scene, you know, and I'm doing the scene with all seriousness, but people are laughing because I have this, I don't know, comedic flair to me. Like, that's just how I roll. Like, I do stuff goofily, you know?
Yeah. Me too.
A physical comedian. I'm a physical person. You know, Mrs. Wiggins was one of my favorite characters of all time. And she didn't even have to say a word. She just walked in with her big old butt, you know, like from Carol Burnett. Do you remember that one? Oh, my gosh. I used to wait on Harvey Korman.
Wow.
When I was in Los Angeles. And I was always like, you know, like, oh my God, you're Harvey Korman. Oh my God.
That's so wild. You're like very creepily bringing him his food and his drinks. And he's like, I like her, but she doesn't say any words, not any words.
Totally.
You're like mumbling them. You're hanging. It's amazing. Here's your chicken cordon bleu. Totally. It's hard. The people that we love the most, we can't talk to at all. I've met a lot of celebrities in my day. And don't get me wrong, like, some of them have been pretty big deal. But if they weren't like my personal absolute favorite, I would just be like, yeah, I can talk to them. People would be like, you can talk to so-and-so? And I was like, yeah, watch, I'm going to do it right now. And I like walk up, hi, how's it going? Like, I go, they're just a person. But then, like, you know, who did I meet? When I met Gwyneth Paltrow, I was a puddle. I mean, and this was early on. She was like in her 20s for sure. And I was just like, Miss Paltrow, you're really good and I like it. And I was like, wow, that did not go well. And I took a photo with her and you can see the awkwardness in the photo. Both of us are like, you know, like, it's not pleasant. I have photos with other celebrities and it's like, look, it's my best friend, George Clooney. Like, how did that happen? Because he didn't seem like a big deal to me. When I saw him, I was like, what? What? Because he's hot? You can't talk to him? Pfft, all right, let's go talk to him. Like, and I didn't care.
I had that with Jeff Goldblum. But it's like, I'm like hanging out with him, you know, hugging on him.
Yeah, seems easy going.
No big deal.
Yeah. I mean, don't get me wrong. Some people give off a vibe of like, hey, let's be friends. I feel like Jeff Goldblum wants to be everyone's friend. So that sounds like an awesome hang.
Yeah.
But at the same time, like, yeah, you get a little nervous when you see these people. Like, oh my God. Yeah. So that's an amazing, what a celeb like experience that you got to have there, especially for comedy. So for how comedy, did you resolve this thing? So you're in the acting class, you go to do this scene, you love comedy, but the teacher is like, sweetheart, this is a dramatic scene. You've come out to tell us that someone's died and you're making everyone laugh. What's going on?
No, she was more like, you are a comedian. She told
positive.
Me who I was.
That's nice.
She told me who I was. I see you. You are this. Read this book.
Oh, so which book did she give you?
Viola Spolin.
Oh, right. Theater Games. Sorry, bring it back.
theater games. And so I was like, yes, and yes, and yes, and yes. So when I moved to California after that, I went to the Viola Spolin Theater on Melrose.
Oh.
The classes. And then I found Second City, took some sketch classes, really enjoyed it, loved Dave Rozowski. And then Second City was so popular that you couldn't really get on stage.
Sure. And
somebody said, well, IO just came. There's a theater called Improv Olympic up, you know, in Hollywood, and you can get on stage there. And I was like, well, okay. So that's when I learned about long form, the Harold, all of the really like fun, like deep, intense improv. So it was taking improv to another level for me. Right. And it became like a master's program, you know? So I was there 24/7. I mean, I would go to work, come home, feed the dog, and then go to the theater. I would do lights for whatever show would let me. I did lights for some pretty freaking amazing shows. And I got on the main stage at level 3 with an all-girl team called Wink, and we rocked it. There weren't any all-girl teams at the time. So this other all-girl team of older gals who were further along in their, you know, journey, called Lucky Ham, formed. And like, it was like Wink or Lucky Ham. And I'm like, well, we're the kids on the block. So it didn't matter. So then, but they liked to make cage matches with us. So that was kind of fun.
Oh, so they might like to make the two lady teams fight against each other.
Yeah. So we promoted the heck out of that. And we brought it. It was a bringer because all these ladies now were fighting. Well, you know, like not really fighting, but you know.
No, I understand. Yeah.
So
idea of improv competitions is a ridiculous scenario purely for the audience, because it's like, right, we are not in competition in any way. Also, the literal action that we are doing is a subjective scenario that's impossible to compare. Like, right, the competition is purely subjective based on the audience, and that is it. Like, it's not like we're playing basketball where you can count up points. Like, no, that's not really how that works. Like, it's purely like, how do you feel in the moment? You know, and I've watched cage matches with teams where I'm like, you know what? I bet if we put this one first and that one second, that would have changed the way they felt about it. It was just the journey of the whole night. And then what the audience felt at the end of the night, they were more connected to this thing because either they were more connected to what started the vibe for them or that final moment that finished the vibe for them. Like, we're giving the audience an experience, right?
Yeah,
and
exactly.
Then they get to judge it. It's almost like the suggestion. It's only there to make the audience feel like they're part of it, like in any way.
I would say there's a positive spin I can throw into the mix here is that when you play with people that are on a higher level than you, you raise your level.
Definitely.
You raise up to meet them. And I think there's power in that. And it was so wonderful. And I remember hearing when the Dogtown movie came out, I got to know one of the guys in it, Tony Alva, and I was talking to him about, you know, like skateboarding and how it became so popular and everything. You were just like these kids from these homes, like nobody, you know, it was just normal kids out skateboarding. And he basically said, we just were trying to copy one another. Like somebody would do a thing and then we would be like, well, I'm going to do it better, you know? And I was like that. Oh my God. And then you guys were just in this bubble of your own kind of like fun making and raising the bar for each other, essentially. And I thought that translates to improv so much because we do that for each other. We raise the bar. And when we're the best teams I've been in were the teams where we would just do it to make each other laugh. It wasn't to make the audience laugh. So I would do something, you know, like the girls we hung out together, you know, and some were close. I was closer to with others, you know, than others. So whenever I was in a scene with one, you know, we had some inside jokes with one another, I would just mess around and make them laugh. And, you know, that had the most value to me when I can make a fellow improviser laugh and enjoy the scene as much as I was enjoying it.
Did you enjoy that community? Was it like, how many 100%. Years were you in the sort of California improv community? How did that work out for you?
I enjoyed it so much. It was like a family. And how many years? I'm not even sure. I would say probably about 6 years. So going through Second City, then going through Improv Olympic and kind of just sticking around even after I graduated, being part of a team. We traveled with our team. So we went to different festivals. We went to Del Close. We were invited to participate in the New York Festival, but none of us could get enough money to go. We went to the Southern Improv Festival. We won Best in Fest there. We got invited to Portland, Austin, and another Arizona to perform. And, you know, the team broke up shortly after. So that was kind of like, so Wink became like the whole time we were doing Wink, it was all girls all the time. But we would always have guys like, hey, can I come play with you guys? Can I get on stage with you guys? And we're like, we'll see. So after we split up, the four of us that remained called it Wank. And then we had guys in.
Yeah, it does change when you get the guys in there.
It does. Well, and do you know, back when I was doing improv, all the teams were like seven guys and one girl.
Yep.
I don't know if it's still like that nowadays.
It kind of is, yeah.
But because, you know, chicks aren't funny still. Like, I don't know.
No. No, I disagree with that particular comment, but chicks aren't funny situation, but you're right. I mean, it certainly remains in the culture for sure. There's a lot of like people who like to pretend that that's what's going on. And I'm like, all right, well, good luck to you. But I had a lot of female teachers and inspiration in my improv journey. So
yeah.
And that plus a healthy dose of naivete, which has floated me through most of my life, is what has, you know, made me really sort of excited for all the women that were involved in my theatrical journey. Like, yeah, there were dudes. And, you know, I realize more now that some of those dudes were, you know, not the best dudes. But at the same time, like, I was always very excited for the ladies, though a few of the ladies have been not so great as well. Not to say that all ladies are just inherently good, because they're not. But like, I was proud that in my journey, now, admittedly, my improv journey is like the last 12 years. Like, I didn't find out about improv until I turned 30, which was already in the 2000s. And so it was like, I didn't, wait, what? That's a thing? And I wish I'd gotten in my 20s. I wish I'd been able to go to some of the places you're talking about, like IO and Second City. I lived in New York for forever, and I lived in New York during the beginnings of UCB. Didn't even know it was a thing. Just never got involved.
It probably wasn't, because it seems to me like IO just came to LA in the early 2000s.
Yeah.
And that was kind of the awakening of improv. Mm-hmm. So, and you know, that happens in the bigger cities before it happens everywhere else. And the guys from UCB, the Upper Citizens Brigade, which was, you know, the Mats, the Walsh, and the, you know,
Besser.
Yes, my favorite one. Sorry, guys.
I'm pretty sure they don't care.
They don't care.
They know people have favorites.
Right. I love them all. They're all equally talented. Indeed. But they were ASSCAT, ASSSSSSSSCAT. IO, and they were performing on the main stage on the regular. I'm sitting next to Amy Poehler because she came to see her buds. You know, she's on SNL now, and she came to see her buds perform at IO because she's in LA. And I'm sitting right next to her, and I'm like, oh my God, oh my God, oh my God. That's another one where I was like, oh my God.
I wouldn't speak to her if I saw her. I wouldn't know what to. Yeah, no. There's too many things about Amy Poehler that make her like, a person where I'm like, everything about you is what I want to be, so I can never speak to you. That's because exactly I've heard that with time travel, you can't talk to yourself. And so I would like to assume that somehow in another parallel dimension, we're the same.
She actually did something like this to me. And I was like,
I love that. I love, that's my favorite part of being in an audience, honestly, is like patting the person next to me like, can you believe this is so funny? Love it. That's my favorite.
That's I'm such a dork. But what was, where was I going with that? So UCB didn't even hit LA until maybe a few years after I kind of split 2007, 2006, 2007-ish from improv, and I was playing pool more, and I became a semi-professional pool player. So around 2006, 2007, UCB had just come in to town, and so all the kids are making the rounds. Second City, IO, UCB, and you know, then now there's a whole bunch of different theaters around, especially New York now, because I'm on the East Coast. I can tell you there's some theaters that are really prominent there. Mm-hmm. And improv is different now. So here we are,
it's like, way different,
you
know, now,
20 years later, and it's a whole nother thing because it's grown, it's expanded like the universe. Mm-hmm. And it's grown into something really amazing.
You know, the pandemic changed it as well. A lot of businesses closed because, you know, improvisers are not necessarily good at business. And it turned out that a bunch of them couldn't just go dormant for 2 years and not make money. Makes sense. I mean, you know, what kind of business model is like, and then you take 2 years off. So like, I get it. The ones that close, like no shade at all. It's hard to run a theater. And, but yeah, the like, who's the top in major cities right now? Unclear. You know, there is a landscape in LA and in New York that is different. There's a few theaters that maintained, maybe they like owned their building, or they had a really good relationship with their landlord and they were able to maintain. But like, you know, both of those major cities, New York and LA, are terrible for real estate, like way too expensive. So hard to maintain theater space, right? And a lot of stuff went online. Yeah.
IO's gone.
Yeah, IO's gone. Isn't IO also gone in Chicago too? Like,
oh, that's heartbreaking.
I don't know. I'm not 100% sure, but like there was a lot, I think so, because it's just hard. Chicago too is expensive, right? So it's difficult to maintain. That's the other reason why Austin theater and improv, it booms, because up until the pandemic, when real estate prices doubled, crazy, everything was pretty affordable. Like, it wasn't too bad. And thankfully, a few theaters in town have maintained because of kind, sweet landlords who they were like, listen, man, I didn't invent the pandemic. Could I possibly keep my lease for a little while? You know, we'll try to find money to pay you rent every month, but you know, we're having a tough time, but we don't want to move. And some of the landlords were like, yeah, we'll work something out with you. And that gosh, so helpful when the landlords were easygoing during this time. I mean, and you know, from a business standpoint, I get not doing that. I get being like a New York landlord. You got to make money. You got a space and it's not being used. You got to put something else in it, you know? And you know, so weird business situations, like how theaters are run, the landscape of it has ebbed and flowed. I think it should be interesting to see how it develops, you know, even from a, from like an online standpoint, because like us all being on Zoom has really connected the international community. Like I am friends and connected with people all over the world. Like now I know about theaters. Now I'm like, oh yeah, I could tell you about two or three Australian improv theaters. Like what? You're lucky I could find Australia on a map before the pandemic. But now I'm all like, oh yeah, I had to interview six people from Australia. So now I have to know not only where it is, but what time zone it's in. And then how that works, you know, just to connect with people. And it's like amazing that we have this technology to do that. But
well, some of the people that were on my podcast are part of that all over the world community, like Jay Succo. Mm-hmm. He does improv with people all over the world, whom you know, and who introduced us. And also Yvonne Landry, during the pandemic, right before the pandemic, she went to Portugal to do an improv festival and bought a house there. And now she's part of their, you know, community, their theater community. So she goes over there and does, you know, some improv stuff there on the regular. So there's so, like you said, it's a worldwide thing. It really is. And even, you know, you can find improv in Russia, anywhere, you know, everyone's doing it.
Yeah. A lot of countries don't like it because it's made up and they can't control it. I don't have specific countries that I want to call out in any way, but there are definitely a couple where they're not so cool with art that they can't keep their finger on.
That's right.
And that can be tough.
It's taken on a political stance, hasn't it? It's taken on more of a, you know, mindful, you know, societal, you know, subculture stance. Like there's definitely a culture of mindfulness that's going on around improv and, you know, bringing up situations.
Yeah. Also the idea of that all of the businesses that were closing or the ones that maintained spent a lot of time working on things about community building, worked on how do we make sure we have an equitable opportunities for everyone in the community, no matter where their background is or how much money they have. Cause the big joke about improv is like, yeah, you can get on stage if you have the money. And it's like, how do we open that up? Like there's got to be artists that are like, just don't have the cash. How do we get them in? Or like, they've never heard of improv because of X, Y, and Z. How do we get them involved? Like, how do we open it up to a larger community and make sure that we're really like honoring the diversity of our city or like really honoring where true comedians come from? Because you just don't know. You don't know where they come from. They come from all over. They happen to be in a dramatic acting class. And then all of a sudden the teacher's like, wait a minute, you're a comedian. So you never know.
You never know.
Unless you have a teacher who's like, here's a book, you know, watching out for that kind of stuff. What's going to happen?
Imagine you're a lawyer and, you know, the head of your firm brings in an improviser, you know, because we know we have corporate improv instructors who are there to teach people how to be on the fly and be on the cuff. And he really tunes into that part of his 7-year-old self that was like, yes, I love playing like this.
Yeah.
This sparks my imagination. He wants to go take a class. So there's where you have, you know, the audience and the diversity, economic diversity. This was a conversation that happened here. There's a heavy improv scene going on at this local arts organization. But it's very insular.
Sure.
But one of their panels was, how do we make money doing this? How do we sustain, blah, blah, blah. And I was like, oh, I'd love to ring in on that conversation. And, you know, I sent them my information, never called me. I mean, I must have sent them so many things like, hey, how do I get involved? And hey, I'd love to teach a class there. I even met with one of the teachers that was already there. Nothing. And I thought, wow, if I can't get, you know, anybody's ear, how's the community getting there? Mm-hmm. Who are we talking to? Who are you listening to? Like, so I feel like some organizations are good at that. Like, and I'm not going to plug, this isn't a plug. I'm just saying what my experience was during the pandemic for my improv access was Groundlings. Not only do they have amazing talent, they had it down to a T. Right? Because they had a coach, they had a director, you know, they had their coach and he was, you know, throwing people in scenes and, you know, setting them up for success, doing it the old school way, but the right way.
So that's who you got connected with while during the pandemic. That's where you were doing your improv and connecting with people. That's awesome.
I wasn't doing it. I kind of have been out of doing it for a long time. I'd like to get back into doing it. But like I said, I can't I can't get any traction here. Groundlings, you got to be a part of their program. This is the truth about Groundlings, which I, from what I understand, is very similar to how Second City was, but on a higher to a higher degree, because we're going back as far as Phil Hartman was from the Groundlings, you know, and wasn't Will Ferrell from the Groundlings?
I'm not sure. Melissa McCarthy, Dax Shepard,
Jack Black.
Yeah. Who all else? The girl who plays Phoebe, Lisa Kudrow is from Groundlings. Yeah. I mean, all sorts of people for sure.
So everybody wanted to be in the Groundlings.
Yeah.
It's kind of like in LA, wherever somebody successful comes from, everybody flocks to.
Yeah.
So when you have that kind of volume of people, you know, it starts to kind of get like, okay, there's only so much further you could go, because all of these people at the top are outstanding and they're top players and they're working.
Yeah.
So these people are going to bring the audience.
Yeah.
So that's who I'm watching. I'm watching, God, what's her name? She's on The Righteous Gemstones. She's the sister.
Oh, yeah. I interviewed
Abby,
her.
Is it
Edie?
Edie. Oh, my God. Edie Patterson.
Edie
so
Patterson.
Amazing.
Yeah. I love
She's
her.
Brilliant. So I'm watching her do improv and I'm
Great.
Dying inside, because I'm like, you're genius. You know, like, she's just so good. I mean, she's got that kind of smirk the whole time. Like, she knows what she's doing. She's got this. And I'm like, oh, you're a genius. You're like me as a good improviser. You know, because there's always that part of us that's like, I suck. I suck at that. That was terrible.
No. Yeah. Why do you think that? No. Did you? No. Here's a question. Do you think that, because like so far in our conversation, you have now said that you don't think you're good at improv, and you'd said that you weren't good at writing, but these are subjective disciplines that are really just a matter of doing them. Neither one really truly require anybody to be skillful or or have a great time. I mean, I've seen thousands of improv shows, and I would say maybe seven were great. But that doesn't mean that I didn't honor the experience of every single performer or writer. And I've also read a number of books and stories where I'm all like, yeah, I don't connect with this at all. But that doesn't mean that it wasn't like well written or a good story, right? So why do you think, like, do you feel like you're something else from?
I feel like in LA, it's so competitive.
Yeah.
So they made you feel bad? It was so competitive. And so you look at the world through a different lens of, oh, I didn't make it.
Sure.
No, I must have not been good enough. Even though you know it's not true, I was there, I was present, I was doing my thing. I was at the top of my game. I sat at the bar, I remember exactly where I was with my friend Lauren Rogers, and I said, let's make an all-female team. We were level three. And people were like, yeah, right. We did it. We were on the main stage in level three. It was unbelievable. Yeah. It's, you know, like, I don't have a problem like having an idea, throwing it out there and making it happen, right?
Yeah.
So I don't have a lack of confidence. It's just that I think that LA piece about, you know, like on the bigger spectrum. So when I bring up somebody like Edie Patterson, not only is she at the top of her game, she's confident and solid all the time. Maybe not. Maybe just the times I see her. Who knows? She might have this inner critic inside of her just like I do. And she's also like making it, like you were talking about earlier. Some of us have day jobs and we still do our creative stuff on the sly. You know, our side hustle is something creative. She is getting paid in her creative zone. Like she's making and creating and getting paid all at the same time, loving what you do and doing what you love.
Yeah.
You know, she doesn't have to have a regular job. She's not waiting tables, you know, at Carney's or wherever.
She might be. We don't know. It's hard. I was like, maybe she is. I don't think she is. Her husband and she still run a theater that stayed open during the pandemic. So,
oh yeah.
So that's pretty
Who's
good.
Her husband?
Her husband is Dan O'Connor, and but no judgment to you for having like a whole, like thoughts about yourself, like I'm not good enough. I am also 100% like that, 1000% like that.
I mean,
the other day, one of my guests referred to me as a success story and I couldn't get out of that fast enough. Like I was like, okay, well, maybe not. I don't know. You know, I definitely could have taken that and been like, oh, thank you so much. Like, I appreciate your compliment, but I did not. I like walked away from that as fast. I dropped that like a hot potato and was all like, okay, well, I'm not really. But if I were talking to someone else, like I got from her point of view why she said that to me. And I will say to you similarly, the only success, the true success, because there's like, yeah, great. There's making money doing this. And there's making money within like Hollywood and whatever. That's one animal, right? If you're not playing that game every day, if you're not schmoozing and out and doing that stuff and like, you know, eating a salad every day and that's it. Like, you know, there's a lot that goes into that, that I'm like, no, thanks. I'm not involved with that. But as long as you keep connected to things that creatively fulfill you, if you continue to get involved with stuff, even just your support during the pandemic of watching the Groundlings shows, like they're not your neighbors, you know? It'd be one thing if you were like, yeah, my best friend's in an improv troupe and I watched her every week during the pandemic. Sure, that's your friends. That's what you're doing. But you like specifically found art and you like were involved with that. So there's something you're connected to this community. You're still one of us. We're just sort of on, have different side hustles while we do things like parent, which is also improvising, as you so eloquently put earlier. But like, you know, it's different pathways. Almost like I have written down, because you mentioned that you were a semi-professional pool player. I'm like, how do you become a semi-professional pool player? It seems like such a left field pursuit. It's almost like you were like, yeah, I was researching for a role. And they were like, yeah, you're pretty good at this. And then I won a contest. Like, what? How did this happen? Right. But it's creative and it's interesting. And it's like you find yourself when you're open, when you're an improviser and you're open to adventure, you find yourself in adventures you did never expected to be part of.
Yeah.
So speaking of adventures that you never expected to be part of, let's talk about your podcast. Let's talk about how you got there. You not only are you doing improv, you know, then you're winning pool contests and you're moving back to Pennsylvania, you know, you're settling down, having kids, you know, whatnot, figuring out that part of life. But then you decided to create this podcast. How did that come up for you?
That came up for me because during the pandemic, we were all at home. And I feel like this is going to go on a philosophy bent here for just a moment, not down a rabbit hole. But creativity kind of welled up in everybody and was coming out of our pores. Mm. So during the pandemic, we were really in touch with that creative side of ourselves. So I was like, how can I do parent support online? And I found a community online on Facebook and I started doing this like kind of parent support coaching thing. And I was in meditation one day and I'm trying to help others understand my kind of disparate life, which was like you so beautifully put, like, I was an actor and then I was a pool player and then I was a teacher, a preschool teacher. And then I was this, like, those are all different things from all different parts of your body and brain and whatnot. And it was because I just said, well, now this and yes, and here's what I'm going to do now. And I really want to do that. And one thing really actually did lead to another. And it was just me following all of my passions, saying yes to all of my passions. And so it came to me that improv was part of my teaching and part of my parenting, because that was kind of the running joke. Like, how do I make a game out of this? What would I do if, you know, I was on a stage. So improv informs, improv has a way of informing our entire lives, whether we like it or not. It becomes like our religion, like you said, like how we live our lives. It informed my relationships. It informed my pool games. It informed my parenting and my teaching. And so I thought, well, of course, it makes total sense. Yes, and parenting. And Yes Day had come out, and I took offense to it because it wasn't Yes and Day. I'm kidding. It kind of took the notion of saying yes in a, it was really perfunctory and I didn't like it, but
yeah.
Sorry, Jennifer.
It's okay. You don't have to agree with all parenting books. There's a lot.
And anyway, so Yes and Parenting came to mind, and I Googled it and I'm like, is anyone else doing this? And there was this lady named Naveen Jain who has co-written a book with Dr. Shefali, who everybody knows because now she's like on the parenting forefront of, you know, parenting philosophers. She's just, I forget the name of her philosophy. Because everything, every adjective you can think of, imperfect parenting, important parenting, power parenting, perfect parenting, you know, all the things you can think of. And so I thought, yes, I am parenting. That made the most sense to me. That's what I was already doing. And everything made sense. And so Naveen was doing, she did like a little article about it. And I was like, okay, she didn't go much further than that. And she didn't bring it up again. And that was probably in 2008 or something that the article came out. So I was like, okay. So she's the only one doing it. Why not? I'm just going to do it. Yes, and parenting. But that became very confusing for people. What do you mean yes? You can't say yes to your kids all the time. You just can't. That's not good for them. Why would you do that? And I'm like, well, okay, this is too hard. I'm not a convincer. Like, if you don't get me right off the bat, I'll try a little. But at a certain point, like, you either get me or you don't. I'm sorry. That's just who I am. So improvised parenting. People have heard of improvisation. It's improvised. Improvised is a word that translates across all modalities and thinking. So that's how improvised parenting came out. So that was the bent. That was the name of my coaching work program. Improvised parenting. We're all improvisers as parents. You know, let's add some rules and framework to it based on the rules of improv, bringing the rules of improv into parenting. And then an article in the New York Times came out and it said, yes, and ... clean your room. And I was like, what? And it was all about improv and parenting, right? Exactly what I was brewing in my witch's pot. And I was like, oh my God. And like the article was out, the people that were mentioned were nobody I knew. So I reached out to every single one of them. One of them was a lady in, I think, like Minnesota, who was doing improv classes for parents, but was shut down during the pandemic and kind of not doing anything. So he improvised her. I mean, he interviewed her for the article. Another one was a woman who plays with Edie Patterson, at the Groundlings. I forget her name, Lauren somebody. And I reached out to her. She never got back to me, but the lady from Minnesota, Corinne Gunderman, did. I reached out to the author. I reached out to everybody mentioned in that article. And I also told the author, hey, here's what I'm doing, you know. And that kind of made me feel like maybe people don't know I'm doing this. So I thought, I'm going to do a podcast. They have been talked about. A lot of people were doing podcasts. A few of my friends were doing podcasts and doing it quite easily on a format called, or a platform called Anchor. So I just did. I just did it.
Awesome.
And I put feelers out there. I said, anybody want to be interviewed, improvisers who are parents? And one of the biggest stars, improv stars in my mind, Paul Valancourt, who was instrumental in bringing IO to LA and one of my first teachers and a coach for my Wink team, my team called Wink, said, I'll do it. And Paul is like still very active in the improv community. He does improv tricks. So he, the weekly, he has, you know, interviews somebody with their improv tricks online, on YouTube, in LinkedIn. You can find him on Facebook. You can find him everywhere. And that was like, wow, my jumping off point and really great conversation with him. And then next was Bill Cott, who everybody knows. I mean, he's, you know, works all the time. Jay Succo then came, and Yvonne Landry, these top dogs to me, you know, what I looked up as like superstars in the improv field were on my show. And I was like, oh my God, I love this. And they were like, yes, improv. Yeah, improv. And I'm like, how do you improvise? How do you bring improv into your parenting? Do you, you know, and that's how it came about. So I'm talking to friends, improv friends, about how they're using yes and philosophy, or the philosophy of improv in their parenting. And you were another one.
I love it. So great. I think that is such a, not only is it a great way to like approach parenting and to like help parents for sure, like sort of let go this idea that they should know the answer to everything, then the idea of talking to improvisers that are also parents and like how those two things work together in your brain and in your like actual life, that's really fascinating. And like excellent marketing move to make it a podcast. Like, it's a great way to get the information out there and to provide it to people who maybe are reticent to join a group or are too far away. And they're like, I don't live in the United States, but I am interested in improvised parenting. They can still listen. Like, that's so really great. And good on you for like wanting to help other people, right? There's so much about sometimes in the creative field, we're very much focused on like, what do I want? How do I want to do this? What am I going to do? So the idea that you're like, how can I be of service to other parents who are going through a tough time? Like, awesome. Like, great.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. That was it. It's like, the last thing you want to do is make parents feel bad, because you start to spin a cycle there, you know, like you start to get into one of those kind of vortexes of negativity. I'm bad. I yelled at my kid, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
We're all fuddling through this. I mean, I'm a child development specialist and I still, you know, I have to rely on the rules of improv a lot of times, because this is often said in my podcast. I have those moments like I've had on stage where, you know, the kid drops something and I'm like, I'll be right back. You know, like you just don't know. You don't know. I don't know a lot of times how to respond in the moment. And so like, that's when I have to get creative, you know? So in my mind, it's going, I'll be right back. But in my improv brain, I'm like, that could be this, you know, and let's, you know, how about that dinosaur over there? No, I don't, you know, but that part of it is like, I'm trying to think of an example for you, like, because there have been a lot of times with my daughter where she's very emotional, you know, she's a lot, she might be who I was when I was younger, but who I learned not to be. Because she was very emotional and very, you know, kind of, she would get on a negative thought and like kind of ramp it up. I always said, you're ramping it up. You know, this is what I say to her. So I try to make a visual for her. Okay. So now you're going like this, vroom, vroom, you're ramping up, revving it up, you know, the motorcycle, because it would be a negative thought that I was trying to give her a different viewpoint on, or trying to help her reframe. And she would always come back to, vroom, vroom, but this, here I go, you know, and like lose her mind over it. So there's a certain point where you have to be, as a parent, just like, okay, you know, I'm going to be over here. And sometimes I would do a song and dance, or sometimes I would just, you know, just do something silly, like change my investment in what was going on with her, shift for me, so it shifted for her. Does that make sense?
Totally. Certainly as a parenting standpoint, for sure. There's a lot of distraction. There's a lot of like, okay, I see that you're freaking out about this. Let's talk about this other separate topic, because this is not going to be resolved for you. And you're going to explode if you continue to talk to me about how you absolutely have to have ice cream for breakfast. But we can talk instead about this awesome pile of toys that you just started playing with. Whoa, what is going on with that truck? Is it crashing? Like, and then they're like distracted and they're no longer like, if I don't have ice cream for breakfast, I'm going to die. And you're like, all right. right. I hear you. I understand. I always go, hey, ice cream's great. I enjoy eating it as well. Yeah. However, we cannot eat it for breakfast. It's not a good base level in your body. I was like, you got to put like the soil down and then some stuff. And we can't have ice cream, cannot be the soil. I'm sorry. Yeah. We do a lot of gardening, which is why I use like, gardening metaphors.
Totally. But- the imagery thing. That's exactly right. Like the motorcycle thing is what I did for my daughter. You do the imagery thing.
So totally.
We're creative thinkers. Yeah. Like, I'm trying to think of another situation recently with my daughter that was like, actually it was with the neighbor's kid, and she was doing something, and like a lot of parents will be like, don't do that. Stop doing that. You can't do that. I'm going to help you. I'm going to help you stop. Instead, like, it's so much easier when you just go, oh, I'm going to do this over here then. If you do that, I'm going to do this. And then you change the focus of what they're doing, because right there, you know, like if they're doing, she was turning that, she was going onto my house and her mom was saying, no, you can't go. We have to go here. And so she was like, no, but I want to do this. And of course she does. She's 3 years old. She wants to do what she wants to do. And so do I. So I'm like, well, I'm over here doing this. And I know like I'm one of her favorites. So I'm like, I'm doing this. You know, and she's like, I'm going to do that.
Yeah.
I'm going to do that. No, I want to do that. So we have to be like, take the focus off what they're doing or not doing. You're not listening to me. And then be creative and go, oh, but over here. Oh, but this is happening over here. So you can do that. But this is what's going on here.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah, you know, the other thing that you just mentioned too that made me think is like the idea of the way, well, first of all, when you're dealing with other people's kids, it seems so much easier. Like,
right, sure,
because you're just not like emotionally tied to what's going on with that child. So you're not like, oh, you've been screaming for 8 hours today. Why is this hour 8 and a half? What's happening? As opposed to like, you see a kid screaming in the store and you're all like, oh my goodness, is it screaming hour? Let's do it. And I like, if I see a little kid and they're screaming and I can see their parents are crazy, like I just try to like turn it into something else. Like I'd just be like, ah, okay, silent scream. And then they like want to play with it, and then it's like, yeah, quieter for the mom, but the kid's still involved in their like dramatic, you know, situation. Oh my God. I love the way you connected with that other child. I love the idea of using games and creativity to like see your way out of you know, really deep, intense situations.
Really nail this by saying, we were talking earlier about the language that kids speak, which is through their emotions, but the language they speak is play. Like, so our kids, all they want to do is play, right? So sometimes when they're hitting us and we're like, no, I don't like that, they're giggling, right? They're laughing at our pain. But in their mind, they're playing a game with you. Oh, I got a reaction out of you. I'm going to do it again. Oh, I'm going to keep doing it. You know, when parents realize, when they open their minds and their eyes to see that all their kids want to do is play. When their kid's laughing at hitting at your reaction to being hit, they're not laughing at your pain. They're laughing because you're playing along with them. They feel like you're playing along with them. Mm-hmm. And now if it's a serious thing, like, oh, he hits all the time and that's just not okay, then that's when you go, oh, I don't want to play this game. I want to play a different one where I don't get hurt. So there's different ways to shift, right? Because that's what we're just trying to do, is shift our kid away from, say, maybe something like a negative behavior, a behavior that's not something we want to really feed. And I think we as parents take on the responsibility of how our children behave. So because that's been passed down to us from generation to generation. So we're taking on this whole responsibility of, oh my gosh, he's crying in public. Oh my God, I got to get out of here. You know, stop that joke, stop it. And like, I don't know if you've been in this position, but this has come up for me where my kid is acting a certain way and I say something, not like this one, like stupid, but I say it like, oh, honey, you better stop that now, because, you know, like, say it so the whole world can hear it, almost because I want to make it seem like, oh yeah, she's being bad, but I'm handling it.
Embarrassment of parenting in crowds is the hardest part. I know that it seems like the hardest part is the like minutia, is the like dealing with them on a regular, constant basis. Absolutely not. It is my ingrained Catholic shame and all of my, I'm embarrassed to cause trouble in public, that when he freaks out, I get steamy. I get all like, and it causes me to be a terrible parent in that moment. Yeah. I'm always a lot meaner in those moments. And I'm like, afterwards, I'm like, oh my God, you cannot do this. This is your emotion. Like, it has nothing to do with this child. Like,
yeah, that's called a trigger. And we all have
them. So hard. So hard. But like, that's one of the things that like in improv, there are lots of scenarios, like in performing improv with adults, there are lots of scenarios where a person potentially says something that's offensive or not cool, or something where it's like, oh no, you've brought this up. I've done this scene before. It's going to go to a terrible rabbit hole. And like children, you have to find a way to like pivot that scene into something else. You're all like, what's that's that? We're here at the Nazi meeting? Okay, well, turns out I didn't understand and I thought it was a nanny meeting and I'm a nanny and I brought some cookies for everyone. I don't understand why everyone's so angry, guys. Have a cookie. Like, and it's like, how do you've just made this so hard? What are you doing? Like, and it happens forever. Oh, you know what? I was thinking, just to bring back, you were talking about that, you know, this kid wants to do what he wants to do and I want to do what I want to do. I think that understanding yourself in the way that you react to things, like, for instance, I immediately, if a person gives me advice, my lizard brain immediately goes, that advice is no good.
Yeah.
Because it's not coming from me, right? Yeah. Because I'm like, listen, I understand everything about the world and I'm not going to be listening to all this advice that people are giving me because they don't get me. That's the voice. That's the voice in my head. So I try to acknowledge that that voice is also in his head. That when my child is like, what's that idea you have? Terrible idea. It's not a judgment on me. It's that he, like I, think our internal monologue is king. And that any other suggestions outside of what I think is the right idea is like, okay, yeah, you don't get it. But let me just smile at you and nod. Mm-hmm, yeah, great advice. I'll listen to that for sure. But at the same, so I'm like, and now I'm an adult, so like I can hear that voice in my head and be like, all right, you don't know what you're talking about. This guy's an expert. Listen to him. But like when you're a child and throughout pretty much most of my life, I'm 43 now, so pretty much most of my life up until now, I've followed that voice of like, I'm not interested in your thoughts and opinions. I'll be doing what I want to do. And so, of course, that's what he's going to do. Of course, when he rejects everything that I say, you know what I mean? Like understanding like yourself is a big, and I think that's a big part of improv, is knowing how you act and understanding the way you express yourself so that you can come in and be a player with other people. You have to know what your instrument is and how it works.
That's so true. Oh my gosh, that's a beautiful way to put it. And parents do too, right? They have to know what their instrument is. They have to know the flaws in their instrument and how they can either resolve, work around, or fix, repair them, you know? Like this is an important part of the process, you know?
Yeah, I mean, you can be mad about how many keys there are on your piano, or you can just use the keys you get.
Yeah.
You know?
Right.
So one final question. We've talked for over an hour. You're so engaging. Thank you so much. It's been so great to chat with you. But I want to ask you one final question, and I feel like it like feeds into what we've already been talking about, which is, how are you personally filling your creative cup? Like, what are you doing for you now that helps you, you know, be creative? We don't all have time to be on stage, or, you know, parenting does not allow you to have the schedule of working at a theater anymore. Like, we can't be 24/7 at an improv school anymore. What is it that you're doing that's filling up your creative cup?
I can't not create. So it's hard to put a frame around it, but I'm always creating. Like there's this saying about having being a self-actualized person is the person who can't not be who they are. right? And so not to say that I'm self-actualized, but that statement does ring true for me because I can't not be creative. I just know that about myself. And so I can't go to meetings because meetings to me are just like this kind of redundant sitting around talking about being creative. I have to actually physically be creating. I can't just sit around and talk about it. Like, it makes me crazy. And it also, I'm constantly creating. So the more meetings I sit in on, the more ideas I have and the more ideas I have to create. You know, like, it just becomes overwhelming at times. So I am 24/7 on the creative highway. So right now the things I'm doing are, I have my improvised parenting group, which I've taken a break from for the summer. And, I've also started, you know, I have my licensure in hypnotherapy, and rapid transformational therapy. And another thing that came up for me was, being an intuitive love coach, and I'm all those things. So I just created, 3 different platforms, the improvised parenting platform for my parents who I can speak to with the rules of improv, and, the intuitive love coach program, which is called Let's Fall in Love. It's just a group online that bring together people who want to put more love into the world. That one is basically supported by donations. And we just sit around and talk about love and how we can bring more love into the world. Because to me, creation, creativity, and love go hand in hand. You know, love is something we feel. Creativity is an expression of who we are. And then the other one is Healing from Within, which is my hypnotherapy practice. And this goes kind of hand in hand with the improvised parenting, because if as a parent on your parenting journey, you are really at the stage where you see this trigger come up and you really want to do something about it, I can help you through hypnotherapy, work through those triggers, that trigger, those triggers, whatever is kind of really troubling you as a parent.
I love the way you have weaved your personal creativity into all the things that you do. I think that that is what separates like a random taking an acting class person who doesn't really get into it versus like a full-time 100% artist in your heart, you know, like there's a different vibe. There's a different way of looking at the world. Yeah. And I love that you are constantly looking for new ways to interact with the world in a creative way.
Absolutely. 100%. I can't not do it.
Awesome.
Oh, and also another thing is I was at a coffee shop and they have a nightly kind of program they're trying to grow called After Dark. And I'm like, you guys need an improv jam.
Yeah, you do.
Thursday nights.
There you go. There you go. I like it. I like
it.
Stay
tuned, folks.
Free for moms, $5 for everybody else.
That's right.
Thank you so much, Lori, for being on the podcast. I really appreciate everything that we've chatted about. This has been a great time.
Absolutely. I've had so much fun talking to you. We could talk for days.
We really could.
I know.
Thanks for listening to Yes But Why Podcast. Check out all our episodes on yesbutwhypodcast.com or check out all the content on our network, HC Universal, at hcuniversalnetwork.com.